one more time.
Yeah.
I hope I'm not disturbing
no,
you.
No, not to die.
There was just one thing I failed to ask you about.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, toward the end of the Von Braun's residence in Huntsville. Several people have told me that Dr. Von Braun had mixed feelings about going to Washington. He knew that it, you know, it might lead to the breakup of the team. And
yeah, he was. Right. Very much, very much. He was, you know, Bob, he is the one, and only he is the only one who was able to keep a team together for such a long time.
That was extraordinary.
Almost. It doesn't exist that a team stays together so many, many years.
Yes, I don't think it has a precedent in history. I don't think there's any other case of that.
It's no case of that. And that is absolute his arrangement, his ability.
Yes.
And this is his character and the way he can lead the men.
And the sheer force of his personality
yes.
and
oh,
his
yes.
stature
absolutely.
And everything.
Absolutely.
Right. Now, I get, I also hear that, and this is not something I'm going to dwell on at all,
yeah.
but that Mrs. Von Braun was not so reluctant, frankly, to leave Huntsville. That,
that's right.
Is that correct?
She was very happy to leave.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, she is a big city girl.
Yeah, I see.
Yeah, she has lived many, many years in Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, she grew up there on that estate, you know, in Pomerania. But then the parents left for Berlin, and she lives there. And she is a big city girl, and she was glad. I guess she pushed it to that.
Mm-hmm. I see. Well, that's what I had understood.
Yeah, that is true.
So you confirm that for me.
Oh, yeah,
And so she, I mean, Dr. Von Braun knew that she would have no reluctance to leave.
That's right.
And I can understand where Huntsville is such a small city.
Yeah, and then, you know, she was so well known and she was so shy. She didn't like
just social chit-chat and...
No, she didn't
right.
like that. She didn't participate. She was very... And then with all the German friends, you know, she was very careful to whom she was talking and that the others maybe were jealous. And she wanted to avoid that all.
I see.
She was really, in a way, very careful. Maybe it was the smartest way, you know. She is made up her mind never talk to any reporters and journalists,
mm-hmm.
which is very smart of her. But
that's true.
Yeah, but and she does not come to any. That I feel very sorry, you know, that she does not participate in. More things here in Huntsville, for instance, the Werner von Braun Forum
mm-hmm.
is always a wonderful thing. I am once a year, you know, I am so happy that we are acquainted and had to do something with all the accomplishments, you know. That's the show at the forum.
Oh,
I'm
yes.
going there all this year. You got the award.
Well, I usually go there every year
right.
that it's held.
Yes.
And then I'm going tomorrow, by the way, to Birmingham for
yes,
his...
Too.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
I hope to see you there then.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm hitching a ride on the Marshall Center bus.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Me too.
All right,
with
good.
Food. I go with food.
Oh, she is too. Good.
Yeah.
Well, I talked to Ernst Stuhlinger too recently, and he's going. So
yeah, he's going too.
There should be quite a group.
Oh yeah.
Well, you all right? You confirmed what I had heard.
And, that's right.
That's right. People had told me that, and that she just, in some cases, she felt that some of the Huntsville families or the social matrons just sort of. They like to show off the Von Browns, you know, to their friends, rather than being true friends.
Yeah, and, you know, she really wanted the privacy, you know, and in a big city she could never.
Good point, good point.
Yeah, and besides she likes the big city.
Sure. Well, good, you cleared that up for me. All right, well, thank you again, Dorel, so much, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Yeah.
Good, bye.
He was reading technical literature for the on his age. And it was during this time that he began formulating his dream. A dream that he would spend the remainder of his life in making come true. By age 22, he had earned the PhD degree in physics and was already involved in serious rocketry. And he would later be awarded at least 20 honorary doctorates. Dr. Von Braun's accomplishments have been treated in at least 10 biographical books and hundreds of articles. So in the short time today, we can only refer to a few highlights of his achievements and a few intangibles of this uncommon man. At Huntsville, he led his small corps of former Germans and many more Americans in the development of America's earliest rockets and space hardware. For example, the Redstone missile, this country's first large ballistic missile, the Jupiter intermediate range ballistic missile, the Persian missile, the Jupiter C rocket, that on January the 30th,
But you said you might have a couple or three little stories.
Yeah, let me give you one, and I'm not even sure you can use it.
All right.
But it's so typical of me. We were going to LA one time, he and I and three other guys. And we left here on our plane, and we stopped in, I believe it was Kansas City. The city is not important to refuel the plane, and we left here late, like 6 or 7 o'clock. And gosh, it was 9:30 or 10 o'clock. And we got there, we stopped at the space base operator to refuel. And I saw this golf cart over there, and asked them if we could borrow it and run into the terminal, see if we could get some dinner. And we, they said, sure, so four of us got on the plane, and the restaurant was already closed, but they seated us, and this lady came up there, and she looked us all over, but she kept coming back to Von Braun, and she thought she recognized him, but she wasn't sure. So finally, after she'd taken our order, she came back. She asked Von Braun, said, do you mind telling me who you are? He said, no, don't mind. So he told her. And she said, well, I thought I recognized you, but I just wasn't sure. He said, would you mind autographing a napkin for me? And he said, well, sure. She said, but my son would just be tickled to death. I wrote him a napkin autograph. So he did. And when she left, he had this little half grin on his face. And he said, you know, once you play the piano on the brothel, everybody knows you. But that was typical of his sense of humor.
Right.
But you like that, you may not can use it in your book, but and nothing more was ever said about it. But
that was somebody's trademark, and I'm trying to remember who it was. That's great.
design in a sense. And this was, let me see if I can tell you when this was. This was in about, we were on the power time. This was in 60, maybe 64, 65, somewhere in there. But I think it was fairly early in the Apollo program. But I've heard that line since then. But he was the first one I ever heard it
from. Uh-huh, right. Oh, that's,
heard it from.
That was in mid-60s?
Yeah.
That's true. Yeah, I think that's usable.
And like I say, I don't know if you use it or not, but I told it when they were doing the filming for the exhibit, and I didn't expect them to use it. Well, they put it in the monitors. I mean, it's been showing at Space and Rocket Center.
Oh,
so, you know, they interviewed a whole bunch of them.
Yes.
And this one was playing up over his office, you know, that we had on display. And I like dying when I saw they put it in public. but anyway.
That's a great illustration of a sense of humor.
Right. I mean, he had a tremendous sense of humor. But quite often it would be so subtle. You'd hardly pick up, because he didn't try to be funny.
Mm-hmm.
He liked being humorous, but he didn't try to be funny. But there's another one that's not funny, but it's absolutely typical of how he liked to just talk to people. And I was a young engineer and this was probably after that one. But we were going out to the West Coast. I believe we were going to LA, not important. And it was a real quick trip. We were going out one day and stay overnight, come back the next morning. Meeting was in the morning. And this was when Learjets had just come out. Man, it wasn't, the only one I knew of at the time was a lease plane in Nashville. Well, our planes were tied up. Well, ours wouldn't have made it in time anyway, because all we had at that time was a G1. And so anyway, we leased a Lear.
Mm-hmm.
And it was General O'Connor, and he and I was on the three. And I don't remember why it was those three, but I do remember it was just he and I sitting in the back of the plane.
And would this have been about, in the 60s?
This was in the 60s. It was probably still in the Apollo program, probably 67, somewhere, plus or minus a year.
Right.
But anyway, we had gone out, and of course those things fly, you know, such high altitude, and he liked to refer to them as the executive fighter. That's what,
uh-huh.
Of course he loved to fly, and because that was his first chance to ever fly it, so he would sit in the right seat and fly.
Do you remember what model of Learjet?
It was the first model, and I don't remember what it was called, but it was the first one that they made. There was a jet, and that thing was really a hot rod. But anyway, we had flown out there and we're coming back, and I would guess we were probably somewhere over Kansas, and we were at a,
on your way back.
On the way back, and it was in the afternoon, mid to late afternoon, and we were at about 41,000 feet. And you know, he loved weather. That was just almost his hobby. He loved flying, and he just loved weather, and formation of weather, and the creation of weather was such a keen interest to him. And to me, this is an example of how he would talk to anyone. And here I was, a young engineer, my early 30s, and had no idea, really, the significance of what I was doing, but it was just part of business. So, I mean, working with him was just, and And here I was, a young engineer down in the ranks, but anyway, whatever the problem was, required me to go out there with him. And on the way back, we were, like I say, we're at 41,000 feet. And let me draw you a picture.
Sure. You want a piece of paper?
Yeah. Because this will make more sense to you. Now, how much of this you want to use and make sure of it. But an anvil cloud is one that looks like this.
Mm-hmm.
And usually it's a little shorter on the front end, like this. And this is a cloud that usually they're very high. And what happens, the air currents get coming up here. The moist air will come up here as it rises. It gets colder and colder.
Mm-hmm.
Moisture starts condensing, and it'll do this, and that's what creates hail. And then when it, depending on how long it stays in this current, the hail then, when it gets heavy enough to fall out of the current,
mm-hmm.
well, it falls down. It's a hail. That's the way hail is generated.
Sure.
Well, we looked at
the
Lear had a great big window in the door, and he and I were sitting back there, and you could look out the window, and we were flying at about this altitude,
mm-hmm.
right here. This was about 41,000 feet, and you could see the cloud above us and the cloud below us. So the pilot obviously didn't want to fly through it, so they flew around it. Well, he said, Jim, let me tell you about that cloud. And he literally started, this would be ground level. He started at the ground level, and he sliced this cloud verbally, just like this. What was happening, the temperature gradients, the moisture content, the air flows, the air currents, he described that in layers as it went up this way, and then he sliced it this way.
Is that right?
And to this day, I have an absolutely, I won't say perfect, but an absolute vivid picture of exactly what happens in an animal cloud. And here we were, we could see the thing above us, way below us, and we flew all the way around it. So you saw literally all sides of it, as we flew around it. But here's a guy now, had a lot of work, had a briefcase full of stuff, both of us were working, but he stopped, and I'll bet you, I mean, that probably took us, I imagine, 15 or 20 minutes. Of course, we were flying like mad, but that thing was huge. And he described the mechanics of that cloud and the function of it and how it forms and how it performs and how it generates hail and how much of it falls in rain and that sort of thing. And just as we flew around it.
Mm-hmm.
And he was such an articulate narrator and an engineer that he could, but like I say, I could almost write a paper on how an anvil cloud functions just from that few minutes of.
And was that the teacher coming out in him?
Well, absolutely.
I mean, I guess he never was formally a
teacher.
Professor. They called him professor, but. But that was wanting to share that knowledge.
That's right. He just wanted to share that. Well,
man,
here was just one person. Now, normally you think, well, gee, he might do that to a room full of people.
Right.
But here we were, just the two of us sitting back there. And he just took time to explain that to us.
Isn't that, that is remarkable.
To a young engineer.
You know, the thought occurred to me, I've got a younger brother who's a glider. Pilot also just loves it, and I know Dr. Von Braun was, and they really have to learn their cloud formations and their updrafts,
right.
Air currents, and all of that. That's probably a little too high an altitude for a glider pilot to, and they only form at high altitudes?
Well, they'll go all the way almost to the ground.
Oh, I see.
I mean, it is a huge formation.
This might be the ground.
Level.
I just wondered how he came. Well, you said he was fascinated by weather.
That's almost a hobby.
That's interesting.
Your bag fell off.
Right? Oh, okay.
But weather has always kind of intrigued him. And I'm sure his pilot, you need to understand weather. So I'm sure.
Sure.
But I think he just had absolute desire to understand the atmosphere and the universe. I mean, that's just.
Mm-hmm.
That was just part of his reach.
Sure. Of course, it certainly applied to the atmospheric
right.
Aspect of rocket flight.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
But it still, it was just this thirst for knowledge, mm-hmm. I guess, that he had in understanding natural sciences. That is interesting. Someone pointed out the two former Von Braun pilots who were at the luncheon yesterday.
Right, Ed Grubbs.
And Feller, F-E-H-L-E-R. Felter or Feller or
right.
And I made contact with them. I may talk with them.
Oh yeah.
So I've got a number of stories about Von Braun and his piloting.
I'll probably tell you, sir.
Yeah.
But those two guys, I told somebody there yesterday. I spent more time with Ed Grubbs on NASA airplanes than I did with my wife almost a year ago.
Is that right?
Because he, and any time, and the way I described it, I took my pastor down with me to that thing yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And,
I think you introduced him.
Yeah, I brought him on the way out. And I told him, I said, those are the kind of pilots you get on the plane. If you're sleepy, you go sleep. You go to work, you go work. You don't worry about the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
Because you know you're in good hands. And those guys were good. They were.
Right. I'm trying to think, who was it? Just recently, I have notes on it, told me a story of that Dr. Von Braun certainly loved to pilot the plane, mm-hmm. to go up and pilot,
right.
Even if the weather was not too risky. And that sometimes he would take, if he was going to fly to a speech and he'd have his speech draft on cards, he'd take it up there in the cockpit with him and kind of work on it as he flew, if it was just straight flight or something. And he could always tell when he was underlining something that, I mean, he'd put them on the column of the wheel and he'd be... If he'd be doing a hard underline, there'd be this little dip. And he said, so the flight to Montgomery or something like this would be a roller coaster. He'd pull it back up. That's quite an insight there. I hadn't heard. And I didn't really know he was that much of a weather buff.
Matter of fact, I think Phil mentioned it yesterday. He had a one-liner that kind of caught my attention, that he was a weather enthusiast or something.
Mm-hmm. Let's go
back.
And
Bill
can
probably give you more detail of that than I can.
Right.
But I'd seen it before, where he loved to look out the windows, see what the clouds looked like.
You know, you were quoted extensively in that Alabama Heritage magazine series. Have you seen that?
I haven't seen it yet.
Mike Wright,
yep.
The historian, did it?
Yep. Matter of fact, your son mentioned it. I haven't seen them yet.
Well, you're quoted all through that thing. And I could send you a copy of that. They did it in two parts, the spring edition and the summer edition of this year. And I wasn't all that familiar with the magazine. I've become a subscriber. I've so admire it now that I got to discover it through this series. I've got these. You don't want my copies.
And I don't know if you want to use this or all because it's... it was not something that he advertised. And that was his Christian belief. Mm-hmm. Even though he was, I think he was Lutheran. He was the most articulate speaker on the relationship of science and Christianity of any man I've ever seen. And really, that's what made me think about Bonnie. I believe it was Ruth. I got interested in that subject years ago, and have done talking and writing on it, but not that I'm a writer, but I have, she gave me, and I collected a lot of them even while he was doing it, just about every speech he's ever given on that subject, and he was by far the most articulate of being able to relate science, physics, Christianity,
nature,
and cosmology and nature and atmosphere, the whole the whole nine yards, and how complementary science is, but most scientists don't believe it, don't realize it, and can't handle it.
Mm-hmm.
But he was the most articulate I have ever seen or heard or read about.
I do have some of that material, and I think I used some in the earlier book, and I've gotten some since then. And he thought along the lines of the greater creation.
Right.
The greater the creator.
That's right.
And I've always felt that way, too, that I don't see how anybody can take a look at the universe.
That's right. Yeah.
And think that there is not some master hand in all this. It didn't just happen, and it has such order to it. I mean, there may be a little, what we would think of as chaos in the midst of all that order. I mean,
chaos.
A volcano is chaotic,
right, but
it's
minuscule on the big scale.
Right.
And but he was, I'm glad to hear that you have been down that path, and, because it was very real to him. But he did not advertise it. If he was asked to talk on the subject, he would.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know who all the groups were. I'm sure some of the papers I have probably said, but it was really the text more so than the audience.
Right.
But Bonnie helped me a lot getting a lot of those stories together.
Oh, I bet. Bonnie's always been so, I mean, the epitome of discretion.
That's right.
And she, you know,
really?
Almost
to her fault.
It's been so close-mouthed, right. But I guess better to err, certainly while Dr. Von Braun was around, she was so loyal and respectful and everything and so discreet. But maybe she's begun to open up for the sake of history a little bit more now. I'm going to give that a whirl anyway. I was trying to think, and this may suggest somebody.
If he had 5 minutes to spare, we'd go in the gift shop and he'd pick up a toy or something from where he had been to bring back to the the children. I mean, he was a, or at least interfacing with him, folks. He didn't talk a lot about his family, but he was very proud of them, the children and his wife, obviously. But he was really a father. I think a good husband, on the surface, it sounded like. But he's certainly a great man to work for and with.
Oh, I'm sure. Do you recall him saying, and I'll make this the last question, I don't really have much material, specific material on, you know, either the moment of the Apollo 11 landing or the launch, or Armstrong setting the first foot down, whether is obviously it had to be an emotional moment for Von Braun and everybody involved. I was down for the Apollo 11 launch, and so I spotted Ernst Stuhlinger leading Professor Obereth around.
Really?
I thought, Lord, this is so poetic.
Right.
Here's the man it while I asked Dr. Olbereth a few questions, and that made a great little sidebar for the Times. And then within a few minutes, Dr. Von Braun passed right by, and he spoke or waved, and all I could think to do was stick out my hand and say good luck before the launch. Not much more to be said, and he seemed to appreciate that. But I've never heard anybody who was with him in some of those critical moments saying he said this or he covered his face or, you know, whatever.
No, I was actually, by that point in time, we were working the launches from up here. We didn't have to go back to the Cape every time. Those of us
right.
were in the HOSC. So, I thought of something a moment ago, but flashed through it. Before it comes back, I'll tell you that might have been worthwhile, but I don't know what it was. And I'm sure some of the others have told you, and I'm not sure you want to use it. He was an absolute master. Lucas did a beautiful job yesterday of defining his ability to run a very complicated mission. You would like this. I'm not even sure you could use it without thinking about it. It was one of the last reviews before, it was either before the first Saturn V launch or the first one with, I believe it was the first Saturn V. It was. And we were having really kind of a final review at Marshall, where everybody was going around and saying that their systems were ready to launch. Well, Dieter Grau was head of the quality organization. And I don't know, I've never seen this in print, but I remember very vividly. We were in the 10th floor conference room, and something was bothering Dieter about some of the checkout. We've had some problems with checkout, and I think it was one of the stages, but I don't remember the details, been too long. But what he would do, he would go around and make sure that everybody was comfortable and were ready to launch. And we called it the Pinamundi pool, where he was pooling really everybody. And we kind of, like I say, facetiously called it, because at that time, the Germans were head of all the labs.
Sure.
And he would...
Did you call it the pole or the pool? Oh, he polled the pool?
Right. Right. And we called it the pool, but it was really, it was a German pool, but it was a pole he was taking. So, but Dieter had a problem. He wasn't quite ready. And he had a problem that he was really agonizing with. Well, Von Braun, he was the last one he asked. And everybody else said, yep, we're ready to go. And it got to him, and he said no. That was a tilt for Von Braun, because he wanted everybody to be comfortable and ready to go. Well, he would talk to Dieter about his problem. Dieter would give him more information, and he would go to the lab director that might be responsible for that particular hardware or whatever it was. I don't even remember what the problem was. But he talked to Dieter, and that group, I bet you, for it seemed like forever, but it was, I'm sure, maybe it was an hour, before he convinced Dieter that it was really all right. So he wasn't going to twist his arm, but he wanted to make sure that he worked Dieter Grau's problem.
And I'll be darned.
So I'm not sure, that one gets a little bit touchy, because there you're getting into awful specificity of how he worked with the team. I'll leave it to your judgment.
Okay.
I
think it can be done where it doesn't put anybody in a bad light.
Right. I wouldn't want to do anything to hurt Dieter Grau.
Sure.
I mean, that's the last thing.
Right.
That's the last thing I could do. But you could you could relate the generically.
Sure.
Without of how that would how he wanted a consensus before moving forward. And he did that during the design phase, during the development phase. He did it all the time.
Did he want unanimity?
That's right. Absolutely.
Or I guess he insisted on it.
No, he wanted it. And, but he wouldn't force you to, in other words, he wouldn't try to change you if you didn't.
Wouldn't browbeat people.
Right.
He wanted a genuine acquiescence or agreement, I guess. Hmm.
He really wanted a technical unanimity.
Interesting. I said one last question. Does anything stick out about his characteristics in running a meeting?
Oh yeah, and the best words you can use are what Lucas read yesterday. They were absolutely perfect. Of course, Lucas is such an articulate speaker, but he had an absolute—he was a genius. Because you would have, sitting around the table, all the development directors, you had a propulsion guy, you had a structures guy, you had an astronics or avionics guy, you had a flight mechanics. I mean, you had all of the disciplines. And if we were working a real technical problem, it might involve all of them or half of them. But each one of those could very articulately describe their concern of the problem, but not all the others thoroughly understood it or could communicate it very fast.
Mm-hmm.
So he would listen to all of them, and then he would come back and say, okay, now, here's my understanding of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And he could say it to where everyone understood it.
Synthesized.
Oh,
there
he was perfect. I mean, he was, that was, to me, it was one of the most significant attributes the man had of being able to listen to diverse inputs and coalesce them into a to an absolutely clear, precise definition of the problem. Having done that, then he could start back around with working the solutions. And he could go back to the individuals that had to be a party to the solution, replay the problem back, and say, okay, now is this what you think, say, from a propulsion standpoint, or from a structures, or from a flight mechanics, or dynamics? And pretty soon, everybody would agree that here's the solution. And he could get to a solution from a very complicated and diverse problem, the best of any man I've ever seen. But Lucas's words yesterday were perfect. Now, of course, he had to hit it in a hurry.
Sure.
But he was absolutely precise in his definition.
I thought he
running a meeting.
Right. That he expressed several things there so well.
Oh, yeah.
I'm probably going to excerpt that in the book,
for
I
me,
think.
There
because
is
he really boiled it down to, and of course I didn't know Dr. Von Braun from the vantage point that you did, but it just seemed to me that, boy, Bill nailed a description of his qualities.
Because almost every one of those bites or subject matters he talked about, he could have written another hour speech on.
Sure.
And I don't envy him having to take all he knew and boil it to 10 minutes. Now that is tough.
Like Benjamin Franklin said when he wrote a 5-page letter to a friend, if I'd had more time, I'd have written a shorter letter. Joe Jones told me this morning that he had every reason to believe that Bill that he really labored over that to make it succinct and to pack as much stuff succinctly into as he could.
Right. And just between you and I, that's the nearest I've ever seen Bill Lucas come to getting emotional.
Mm-hmm.
Now, most people probably didn't even recognize it. I could tell it just in his voice.
I didn't. I didn't pick up on that. Yeah.
And if you notice, his eyes, they were very red when he finished.
Mm.
But he didn't, man, his voice didn't break. But I could tell from the subject matter and just the way he was reacting that was tough for him.
That's interesting. You know, and I'm going to let you get back to work here. Thank you, Jim. I talked to Bill Lucas about, I guess, a year and a half ago about Cummings again. You see where I got to these 215 interviews. And he gave me one of the best interviews, impromptu. I mean, obviously he gave it a little thought, but expressed things very well. And he had a number of dealings with Cummings and then observed some of his impact in the community.
Of course, I'm not going to tell you how to write a book. That'd be...
Oh, please.
What you ought to take is that Lucas' speech he made yesterday and pick out subjects that he hit on that you have not had either insight into or anyone else mention it. But if it's interesting, go back to him and say, all right, now tell me what's behind this.
That'd be interesting.
I'm sure he would do it. Also, just between you and I, yesterday is really the first time he's much gone public.
Is that right?
I was delighted when I heard that he was going to do it because two reasons. It would be good for him. But he has suffered tremendously as an individual and professionally. But I don't know of a public speech he's given.
Is that right?
Yes.
That's 86.
Yeah, see, he and Blair Malloy took the fall.
Right.
He took it for that. As much as any other government people. Larry a little bit more than Bill.
Right.
But, and that's right, and I say you may have to treat it carefully, but you can always go back to his speech and say, look, you said this here. Now, there's obviously more behind it than you had time to talk about. And you might get some very good insight.
Let me give that some thought. It sure could.
But it's a beautiful entree for you.
It's just an exceptional piece, and I hope our editorial page, I sort of have a consulting role with the news department now rather than a chain of command, but I thought it was an extraordinary work there. But
he did a
right
good job of presenting it.
Oh, he did. He did. Jim, this has been really helpful.